Chapter 64. Goaded on by Pitt's flying tackle, Fox charged up the steps like a maddened rhino and threw his great weight against the bodies of both men. Pitt went limp and fell off to one side. Emma struggled to bring the gun to bear, but Fox slapped it away as though it were a toy in a child's hands. Then Emma went for Fox's crotch, clutched his cock and balls, and squeezed ruthlessly. It was the wrong move. The captain roared like thunder and reacted by swinging both his massive fists from over his head down upon Emma's upturned face, crushing cartilage and tearing skin. Astoundingly, Emma maintained the pressure. Though his groin felt as if it were bursting in white-hot agony, Fox was wise enough not to try knocking away the hands that held him like a vice. Calmly, purposefully, like a man who knew exactly what he intended to do, he gripped Emma's head and began pounding it into the metal deck landing with every ounce of strength in his tree-trunk arms. Mercifully, the pressure eased, but shrouded in his pain-lashed rage, he kept smashing away until the back of Emma's skull turned to pulp. When his fury was finally spent, he rolled over and gently massaged his groin, cursing. After a minute or two, he rose stiffly to his feet, took the coat collars of the two inert men, and dragged them up the stairway. One more short flight, a few yards down a passageway, and he came to a cargo loading door in the upper starboard side of the Iowa's hull. He cracked the door enough to let in daylight and examined Pitt's wound. The bullet had scored Pitt's left temple, causing, at worst, Fox figured, a nasty gash and concussion. Then he checked Emma. What skin that was visible through the mask of blood on the assassin's face was turning blue. Fox went through his pockets and found only a spare clip for the Hawker Rodine pistol. Strapped around a heavy woolen sweater was an inflatable life vest. "A non-swimmer, hey?" Fox said, smiling. "I don't guess you'll be needing this anymore." He removed the vest from Emma and tied it around Pitt. Reaching into his own coat pocket, Fox took out a small notebook and made several notations with the stub of a pencil. Next he took his eelskin tobacco pouch, emptied the contents, inserted the notebook, and tucked the packet snugly under Pitt's shirt. The cord to the CO2 bottle was yanked, and the vest hissed as it inflated. Returning to Emma, Fox grabbed the corpse by the front of the sweater and pulled it toward the open hatch. The weight was too much for the angle of Fox's grip, and the sweater slipped over Emma's head. Something around Emma's upper torso caught Fox's eye. It was a nylon binding that tightly circled the chest. Entranced, Fox undid a tiny clasp and the nylon fell away, releasing two small rosebud-tipped mounds. For a moment, Fox stood petrified. "Holy Mother of Christ," he murmured in awe. Emma had indeed been a woman. Dale Jarvis pointed at the viewing screen. "There, just below the second gun turret, on the side of the hull." "What do you make of it?" asked the President. "Someone has opened the forward loading hatch," answered Kemper. He turned to General Higgins. "Better alert your men to the possibility that the crew may attempt an escape." "They won't get 10 feet past the shoreline," said Higgins. They watched as the hatch was thrown back to its stops, and a monster of a man stepped to the threshold and threw out what looked like a body. The form hit the water with a splash and disappeared. Soon he returned with another body, but this time he lowered it on a line to the leisurely flowing current. Almost tenderly, it seemed to the men in the conference room, until the inert figure bobbed and floated free of the ship. Then the line was cast away and the doors closed. Kemper motioned to an aide. "Contact the Coast Guard and have them pick up that man drifting in the river." "What was that little performance all about?" The President's question echoed the thoughts of the men at the table. "The hell of it is," Kemper said quietly. "We may never know." After what seemed like ages, Hiram Lusana found a doorway that exited to the main deck. He stumbled outside, bone-chilled in his thin business suit, clutching the sack of bomblets in both hands. His sudden emergence into daylight blinded him, and he paused to get his bearings. He found himself standing beneath the aft fire-control bridge, forward of the No. 3 gun turret. Small arms fire whistled about the ship, but his mind was intent on disposing of the quick-death bomblets, and he was oblivious of it. The river beckoned, and he began sprinting toward the bulwarks edging the outer limits of the deck. He still had 20 feet to go when a man in a black rubber wetsuit rose from the shadows of the turret and aimed a gun at him. Lieutenant Alan Fergus no longer felt the burning pain from the hole in his leg, no longer felt the agony from seeing his combat teams cut to pieces. His whole body was quivering with hatred for the men responsible. It did not matter that the man in his sights wore a business suit instead of a uniform, or that he appeared to be unarmed. Fergus saw only a man who, in his mind, was murdering his friends. Lusana halted abruptly and stared at Fergus. He had never before seen such cold malignity on a man's face. They looked into each other's eyes from no more than 12 feet, trying to exchange thoughts in that brief instant. No word passed between them, only a strange kind of understanding. Time seemed to pause, and all sounds diminished into a blurred background. Hiram Lusana knew his fight to rise above the filth of his childhood had culminated in this time and place. He had come to realize he could not be the leader of a people who would never fully accept him as one of their own. His path became clear. He could do far more for the oppressed of Africa by becoming a martyr to their cause. Lusana accepted the invitation of death. He threw Fergus a silent smile of forgiveness and then leapt toward the bulwarks. Fergus pulled the trigger and sprayed a pattern of automatic fire. The sudden impact of 3 bullets in his side pitched Lusana forward in a shuddered dance that pounded the breath from his lungs. Miraculously, he stayed on his feet and staggered drunkenly on. Fergus fired again. Lusana fell to his knees, still struggling toward the edge of the deck. Fergus watched in detached admiration, vaguely wondering what drove the incongruously dressed black man to ignore at least 12 bullets in his body. With brown eyes glazed with shock and with a determination known only to a man who could never quit, Lusana crawled across the deck, holding the canvas sack against his stomach, leaving an ever-widening trail of crimson behind him. The bulwarks were only 3 feet away. He fought closer, despite the blackness beginning to cloud his vision and the blood streaming from the corners of his mouth. Summoning an inner strength born of final desperation, he threw the sack. It hung on the bulwark for an instant that seemed frozen in time, teetered, and then fell into the river. Lusana's face sank to the deck, and he passed the gate into oblivion. The interior of the massive gun housing reeked of sweat and blood and the pungent odors of powder and heated oil. Most of the crew were still in shock, their eyes glazed, unknowing, dulled with confusion and fear. The rest were lying amid the machinery in unnatural poses, blood trickling from their ears and mouths. A charnel house, Fox thought. A damned charnel house. God, I know better than the butchers who slaughtered my family. He peered down the center elevator tube to the magazines and saw Charles Shaba hammering away with a sledge on a shell cradle that had become wedged 10 feet below the turret deck. The interlocked doors, designed to prevent accidental breach failure from communicating explosive flash to the magazines, were jammed open, and to Fox it was like looking into a bottomless pit. Then the black void seemed to fuzz, and he suddenly realized the problem. The air was too foul to breathe. Those who survived the concussion caused by the Satan missile were dropping from lack of oxygen. "Open the outside hatch," he roared. "Get some fresh air in here." "She's buckled, Captain," a voice rasped on the other side of the turret. "Jammed tight." "The ventilators, why aren't they operating?" "Blown circuits," another man said, coughing. "The only air we've got is what's coming up through the magazine tubes." In the choking haze and gloom, Fox could barely make out the form of the man who spoke. "Find me something to pry the hatch open. We've got to make a path for cross-ventilation." He made his way around the bodies and over the huge gun mechanism to the hatch that opened to the main deck. Looking at its 7-inch-thick wall of hard steel, Fox could well appreciate what he was up against. The only points in his favor were the shattered locking prongs and the inch of daylight showing at the top where the hatch had been blown inward. Someone tapped his shoulder, and he turned. It was Shaba. "I heard you down in the magazine tube, Captain. I thought you might need this." He handed Fox a heavy steel bar 4 feet long and 2 inches thick. Fox wasted no words of appreciation. He wedged the bar into the opening to the outside and pulled. His face flushed with the effort, and his great arms trembled, but the hatch would not budge. The obstinacy of the hatch came as no surprise to Fox. It was an age-old Scottish adage that nothing fell to a man's lot on the first try. He closed his eyes and sucked in great breaths, hyperventilating. Every cell in his body focused on kindling the strength locked within his immense body. Shaba watched, fascinated. He had never seen such a demonstration of sheer concentration. Fox reinserted the bar, paused a few seconds more, and finally began to heave. It looked to Shaba as though the captain had turned to stone. There was no obvious hint of effort, no tenseness of the muscles. The sweat began to pop from Fox's forehead, and the tendons of his neck bulged and tautened. Every muscle turned rock hard with strain. Then, slowly, incredibly, the hatch shrieked as steel scraped against steel. Shaba could not believe that such brute force existed. He could not know of the secret that drove Fox far above and beyond his normal energies. Another inch of light appeared between the hatch and the turret armor. Then 3 inches. 6. And abruptly the mangled steel twisted from its broken hinges and dropped to the deck with a great metallic echo. Almost immediately the stench and smoke were driven outside and replaced with cool, damp air from below. Fox stood aside and tossed the bar through the hatch, his clothes soaked through with sweat, his torso shuddering as he caught his breath and his pounding heart slowed to normal. "Clear the breaches and secure the guns," he ordered. Shaba looked blank. "We've lost hydraulic pressure to the power rammer. It can't be reversed to remove the shells." "Damn the rammer," Fox snorted. "Do it by hand." Shaba said nothing in reply. He had no time. A gun barrel poked through the open hatch, and a hail of bullets ricocheted throughout the armored chamber. The burst whistled past Fox's side. Shaba was not as lucky. 4 bullets entered his neck almost simultaneously. He sank to his knees, his eyes staring uncomprehendingly at Fox, his mouth moving but expelling no words, only a gush of red that rivered down his chest. Fox stood by helplessly and watched Shaba die. Then a rage swelled inside him, and he whirled and grabbed the gun muzzle. The heat from the barrel seared the flesh from his hands, but he was far beyond any sensation of pain. Fox gave a great pull, and the seal outside, stubbornly refusing to let go of his weapon, catapulted past the narrow aperture and landed inside, his index finger still locked on the trigger. There is no fear in a man who knows with certainty he is about to die. Fox did not possess that certainty. His face was white with fear, fear that he would be killed before the quick death shell inside one of the 3 guns could be deactivated. "You bloody fool," he grunted as the seal kicked him in the stomach. "The guns! Inside the guns! A plague!" The seal twisted violently and slashed out with his free hand to Fox's jaw. Fighting to keep the muzzle away from his body, Fox could do nothing but absorb the blow. His strength was draining away when he lurched backward and fell partially through the hatch opening, trying with one last mighty effort to yank the gun from the seal's grasp. Instead, the flesh came away from his palms and fingers, and he lost his grip. The seal jumped sideways and lowered the gun, aiming it with agonizing deliberation at Fox's stomach. Daniel Obasi, the young boy sitting in the turret officer's firing booth, watched in numbed horror as the seal's finger tightened on the trigger. He tried to yell to distract the killer in the black wetsuit, but his throat was dry as sand and a mere whisper rasped through his lips. Out of sheer desperation in what he prayed was his one hope of saving his captain's life, Obasi pushed the red fire button.